This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 122 of the USDF's official podcast. I'm Chris Stafford, and coming up on this week's episode, we will have part two in the series of What Every Dressage Rider Should Know About Footing, brought to you by Dr. Hilary Clayton. And we'll also be hearing from Angela Bean, who recently graduated from the USDF L Education Program. But first, the USDF is accepting nominations for the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame Lifetime Achievement and Member of Distinction Awards. The deadline for these nominations is May the 1st, and you can find information on the nominating process and how to submit a person for consideration on the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame website. The USDF relies on its members to nominate deserving individuals for recognition. So if you know anyone who deserves to be recognized for their service to the USDF, please go to the website and follow the link to the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame pages at usdf.org. Our first guest is Angela Bean, who recently graduated with distinction from the USDF L Judge Education Program that was hosted by the Virginia Dressage Association. Angela is here now to talk about her experiences at the program and how it helped her as a rider, competitor, and as a trainer. Angie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about the L program and how you've benefited from it, and you've been writing some articles about the subject anyway. So where would you like to begin to explain what this means to you and how you have benefited from the program?
Well, as a competitor, going through the L program was invaluable to letting me know what is important to show off to the judge, because the skill set of showing is a bit different than the skill set of training. And being able to present the training in a way that is rewarded the most in the show ring, you know, that was kind of the whole point of me going into the L in the first place, because that's going to benefit me as a professional and for being able to show clients horses well. And it also has helped me prepare students better so that they can show a well-presented and organized ride for their judges.
Well, explain to people what you do and as a professional, your business and where you are in the sport.
I run Straightforward Dressage. It is a 23-stall, 25-acre facility in Gunmore, Pennsylvania. It's about 40 minutes west of downtown Philadelphia. And we train dressage horses of all breeds, from, you know, starting horses through FEI. And we have everything in the program from, you know, Dutch warm bloods to fjords. So we've got a little bit of everything here. And I have... A bulk of the business is there's a handful of horses that I primarily ride, three or four, and a couple I show for clients. And then there's several horses that I ride once a week or twice a week and help the student develop the horse, and then the student actually competes the horse.
Okay. So
I coach for them.
Right. So you're deeply involved with this. Now, when did you get involved with the L program itself?
I took the L program the first time 6 years ago. It was offered locally. They went through the program then, and it made a huge difference in my ability to prepare myself and my students then. And then recently I did the L program this last year. The first time I went through, I passed. And then this time I went through with the goal of passing with distinction to move on into the small R program, which I did do. So now I'm waiting to find out if I'll be accepted into the small R program.
Okay, so going up through the ranks then. Well, let's talk specifically about the L program and really a little bit more, if we could, drilled a bit deeper into what it means to you and how you've benefited and why you would recommend it to others.
One of the big things that became really clear with the way the information is presented in the L program, it starts with the A, B, and C sessions that go a lot into the basics of the horse, how the judge arrives at the number, and the biomechanics of the horse. So it really clarifies that your goal in presenting a horse is not to present a good leg yield or a good shoulder in. It's to present a horse that is so well balanced that they can easily do a leg yield or a shoulder in. And one of the biggest things that came out about it is that when the judges are evaluating the horse, what they're looking for is a horse that's trained to the level, not a horse that's training at the level. So the idea is to present the horse in such a way that what they're showing off is the easy stuff, not the stuff that they're working hard on at home. And I think a lot of riders go in to the show ring and present a horse, you know, they're kind of hoping certain movements will work because they're not solidly trained at what they're doing. And then when they get their results back after the class, they're discouraged by their results. And it's not that what they did necessarily was bad. It just wasn't polished enough to be rewarded in the show ring yet. And the way the material is presented, because it starts with talking about basics and the gaits and the way the horses move and the balance of the horse, it really helps people understand that.
And that in itself is very important, you know, to actually have arrived at that level, not working toward it.
Yes.
All right, so unpack that a little bit more for us and some specific points that you've directed in your articles, Angie, if you would.
Well, what the criteria that I mentioned in the article and that I use for my own personal riding is if I can't recreate a specific movement 75% of the time with confidence, I don't feel like it's ready to be put into a performance in front of a judge yet. So if I'm going around and I make a shoulder in and I do one and it wobbles off the line of travel, and then the next one is more neck in than shoulder, and then the third one is a competition quality shoulder in, and then the fourth one, the horse tightens and braces and comes above the bit. That shoulder in is the horse understands the shoulder in, but they're not strong enough and balanced enough and confident enough in it yet to be able to do it in an artificial environment with an outside evaluator, which would be what we would call a horse show. So when I get to where the shoulder in becomes, you know, I go around the corner, I set it up, I turn my shoulders, I drop my inside knee, boom, there's a shoulder in, and I can do that 3 out of 4 times, and then I feel like that movement is ready to be then put in front of a judge.
That's a good way.
Not sure if that directly answers your question.
But. Yes, exactly. Yes, and I think, you know, there are other examples of that, that it is at performance level and not training level.
And I find that when I impose that standard on myself and on my students, it means that when I go down the center line, I'm not worried. You know, I know that it's going to work, which is going to then let me relax a little bit, and then my feet will be a little softer, and then the horse can swing through and show off their best gaits the most, which is really the biggest advantage of making sure that the horse really understands what they're doing when we present it.
So it really is established. And I mean, and we talk about being confirmed at a certain level. Is that how you would describe it?
Yes, and if you use the judging numbers, you know, the 1 through 10 scale, a 7 is fairly good, and that would be, you know, confirmed. So if a horse can go around and perform a movement for a 7 on a consistent basis, that would be confirmed. A 6 is sufficient to the level, which means they can do it. It's recognizable, but it's not, it doesn't look easy yet. And then that's where the judge, you know, the hard part of the judge is then in the comments, they have to explain what they would need to see to make that 6 into a 7. You know, the comments are not necessarily critical of the 6. They're, this is what it needs to then become up to the 7, which is performance standard. And then once you've got something that's performance standard, then the quality of gaits and the presentation can then bump it up even higher depending on the horse.
Right. Are there any other points from those articles that you would like to share with us and draw attention to?
Well, there's one thing that I'm not sure if I highlighted it in that article enough, in that specific article, but I think about a lot when I'm performing, when I'm competing with a horse, and that is that every horse has highlights and every horse has things that are harder for them. And it's important in that when I'm presenting a picture of a horse and in the warm-up preparing for that picture, to make sure that both the horse and I are thinking more about the highlights than the critical things. Because if the horse goes in after a warm-up where I've picked on a weakness for 30 minutes, and then I go and present that horse to the judge, that weakness may have improved a little. by the time I put it in front of the judge. But the overall flow of the ride could be compromised because the horse is thinking about the limitations and I'm thinking about whatever their limitation is. So if instead, when I'm preparing just before going into the ring, about thinking about the horse's highlights, what does this horse bring to the test that makes it be special and they're owning it as their own performance, that's going to make the overall presentation of the test look that more interesting. You know, to me, it's a little bit like performing a piece of music. First, you would learn the notes and you would learn the dynamics, and then you would then know it well enough that you can make that piece of music really sing for you. And when I'm preparing a horse for a dressage test, that's always what I'm trying to do. And that adds that little extra bit of flair that takes it even above the judging information that I learned in the L and actually makes it into a fun performance to ride. And a lot of times that's rewarded also.
Right. So in summary, how would you summarize the L program and recommend it to our listeners here and the benefits that they can glean from it?
Well, I think that going through the L program, one of my students audited the ABC section of it, and her takeaway from it was after she went through the L program, she felt like it eliminated the smoke and mirrors of reading her score sheet. She understood what the judges were looking for and what the judges wanted to see in a performance, and it helped her more prepare her horse to and herself for going in front of the judge. And she actually got to the point where she felt like when she looked at her score sheet, she a little bit knew what the judges were going to pick up on his highlights and his weaknesses. And then it just came down to how well did her horse compare to the others that presented that day. It made it a lot more objective, a lot less emotional, and in the long run, a lot more fun because it wasn't overburdened by all of this, I hope I'm good enough. She knew what the standard was because it was right there presented in the information in the L and in the information that's written on the dressage test. So I think that if every rider went in with armed with that information of knowing what exactly is being expected of them in their performance, then they would be a lot more happy and satisfied with what they, what the score sheet said when they got them back.
A lot more confident in the performance, as you say. You can relax then as a rider, knowing that you've reached that standard comfortably. And a lot more satisfying in terms of the training scale, too.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for coming on the program, Angie, and explaining that to us. And I'm so glad that you have benefited from it. And hopefully our listeners will follow your example. So thanks again for your time.
Thank you very much.
And finally, we conclude our two-part series that was taken from the education session of What Every Dressage Rider Should Know About Footing, presented by Dr. Hilary Clayton during the 2015 Adequan USDF Annual Convention.
So what do I think you need to know about footing? Well, I think you need to understand how the horse's hoof interacts with the surface as he steps on it. And we're going to talk about the impact phase, the loading phase, and the propulsion stages of the stride. And then I think it's important to have some knowledge about how the properties of the footing affect the horse's hoof and the rest of the horse's limb, and indeed they're going to affect the horse's entire body in terms of his locomotor pattern. And we're also going to look at how different dressage movements have different requirements from the footing. Right, so footing is a sport-specific velocity. Now, the property of the track that causes the hoof to slow down is what we might call grip. Okay, that's, I think, the term that most of us would understand. The more technical term is the shear resistance. So it's a resistance to a shearing force which is acting horizontal to the track surface. As the hoof is decelerated, it sends a wave of concussion up the horse's leg. Of course, we all know that concussion is not a good thing for our horses. So let's think a little bit about the grip. If the horse is moving on a hard surface, a firm surface, the risk of a horse sliding on a hard surface like blacktop, let's say, depends partly on the surface that the horse is coming into contact with, but also partly on whether the horse is shod or not shod. Right, we have a coefficient of friction that is specific for both of the surfaces. So the coefficient of friction is higher for a horse that's barefoot, so he's less likely to slip than a horse that's wearing shoes. Now, mostly we're not riding our horses on the blacktop, I hope. We're riding them on surfaces that are usually granular surfaces. Like, you know, sand is made of granules, so it's a granular surface. And on those kinds of surfaces, the foot isn't just going to skim over the top of the surface. It's going to go down into the surface and displace the granules. So we have frictional forces generated in the horizontal plane, both between the hoof and the surface of the sand, or the footing, and also between the particles within the footing. Right? And it's how those particles behave that determine a lot of the properties of the different types of footing. So I show you here three different types of foot. Here's a hoof landing on one of the synthetic type arenas. And you can see there's very little slipping there. On sand, the hoof will slip forward a little ways, and you can see that by the way that the sand is kind of spraying up in front of the hoof. If you were riding a reiner, then you would want a surface that would allow the hoofs to slide a long way, right? So, you know, different types of footing for different sports. Okay, so moving on now to the main weight-bearing phase of the stride here. So this is the phase after that immediate impact phase when the foot is decelerated, then the horse's body weight passes over that grounded leg. And as the leg is loaded, the fetlock sinks towards the ground. And the fetlock is lowest, the joint is maximally extended in the middle of the stance phase, and that represents the moment when loading of the leg is maximal. So fetlock angle is actually proportional to the amount of load or the amount of weight that the leg is bearing. Now, I've shown the ligaments and tendons on the back of the leg here like a spring, and that's exactly how the superficial digital flexor tendon and the suspensory ligament behave. Those two structures have a lot of elastic tissue within them, and as the fetlock is sinking towards the ground, that elastic tissue is being stretched. And just like a piece of elastic, when the tension is removed, it springs back, releases the elastic energy. So as the fetlock sinks, our elastic spring is stretched. And then as the body weight, horse's body weight, is passing on over the grounded leg, the fetlock rises, and then that spring retracts, recoils, and bounces the leg off the ground. So I said that the lowering of the fetlock is proportional to limb loading. Also, the amount of stretching in the superficial flexor tendon and the suspensory ligament is proportional to the amount of loading. And of course, those are structures, especially for us, the suspensory, that are quite often injured. So we get higher loading of these elastic structures in heavier horses and at faster locomotor speeds. And these are things that predispose to pulled suspensories and bowed tendons. Both of these injuries are actually repetitive strain injuries. So it's a matter of the horse has no choice during locomotion. He has to load every limb during every stride. And eventually, that can lead to a repetitive strain injury. So we might surmise that surfaces that can reduce the loading on the limbs might be good because they would reduce the injury risk. So the property of the surface that affects the cushioning or the loading or the shock absorption or the damping, whichever word you'd like to use, we refer to often as the cush. Right? That's, I think, a word that's used a lot by footing people. So again, we need some cushioning, but not too much. And when we think about how cushioning is measured, it's expressed as a percentage reduction in the maximal force compared with concrete. But usually we don't compare it with concrete. We test different arenas and then compare one type of footing with another. So this cushioning is achieved when the particles of the footing are actually compressed together or they move relative to each other. And we can see evidence of that when we see a hoof print left in the footing. Now, when footing is compressed like that, it may behave elastically or it may behave plastically. So elastic behavior, elastic materials rebound to their original shape after they've been deformed. So imagine this rubber ball, and it's being thrown and bounced off the ground, and it rebounds. When it's on the ground, it actually gets compressed, it gets flattened on one side, but then as it bounces back off the ground, it becomes round again. And if our footing had that perfectly elastic behavior, it wouldn't show any foot hoof prints. But I don't think we ever see that in our actual arenas, do we? So our arenas are somewhat plastic in their behavior. So plastic materials retain their new shape after it's been deformed. So if you think of a piece of plasticine or silly putty, when you throw that on the floor, it gets flattened on one side and it stays flattened. So that would be plastic behavior. And footing that is somewhat plastic will retain the shape of the hoof print. So most of the materials that we actually use for arena footing, they have some elasticity, but they also have some plasticity. And the term we usually actually apply to them is viscoelastic, which means that their deformation is also dependent on the rate at which the hoof loads the surface. So the response of the surface depends partly on how long the hoof is in contact with the surface and also on the rate of limb loading. So, you know, the footing is quite a complex subject. But I think if you can just absorb some of the basics, then, you know, it will help you to understand different types of footing. So when we looked at that little hoof print in the footing, that was a result of the vertical deformation of the surface, which is a function of how hard the surface is. So clearly things like blacktop are quite hard. The footing that we put in our arenas is less hard. The horizontal deformation of the surface, so the sort of sliding marks of the hoof into the surface, those reflect the shear resistance or the grippiness of the surface. So hard surfaces are going to stop the foot very abruptly, and that's associated with high concussion, and that's what we don't want. So we want a surface that will let the hoof fall into it a little ways and slow down that vertical motion more slowly. And when we talk about the effects of concussion, these don't appear overnight usually. Usually the effects of concussion appear over the long term. So it takes not just days and weeks and months, but years before you actually see these effects. So it's like it's a silent disease just developing in the horse until the day that it becomes clinically apparent. And when that happens, then the damage is already present. And the type of damage we see from concussion is degenerative joint disease, DJD, osteoarthritis. An example is ring bone. In general, concussion is greatest at the joints that are lowest on the leg, coffin joint, Paston, fetlock. And of course, those are areas where we do see clinically a lot of problems. Softer surfaces are more likely to be associated with soft tissue injuries, and we talked a little bit about the etiology of injury in the elastic tissues. The other thing that's important in relation to really soft surfaces is that because they give way as the leg pushes off, the muscles have to work harder to maintain the same gait and speed, so the muscles get fatigued more quickly. And when the muscles are fatigued, then the horse has to rely more on the superficial flexor tendon and the suspensory ligament to support the leg. Now, moving on to the propulsion phase of the stride, okay, the phase where the leg is actually pushing the horse upwards and forwards. In this phase, we need a surface that, again, is secure for the foot to push against it, and ideally, that would allow the toe to dig in a little bit. Now, the reason that's important is that during the propulsion phase, And just before the heels lift off the ground, there's a lot of tension in both the check ligament, which is here coming off the back of the cannon bone, and then going on down through the deep flexor tendon, around the navicular bone to the coffin bone. So there's a lot of tension in that tendon, and that tendon is also pressing against both the navicular bursa and the navicular bone. So horses that have heel pain or navicular problems, this is one of the stages of the stride that's really painful for them. And if the toe can dig into the ground a little ways, then it reduces the amount of tension in those tendons. So that's, you know, a really important characteristic of the footing. And of course, on something like blacktop, the toe can't dig in at all, whereas on most of our arena surfaces, there is enough, a low enough shear resistance for the toe to dig in. So I said that when the horse is moving in a straight line, the toe has to be able to dig into the surface. But when he's performing a lateral movement and the legs are crossing, then he's going to contact the surface with the outside or inside of the hoof and then push off the opposite side. So now he's rolling side to side over the hoof as well as rolling back to front. So when we think about shear resistance, it's another of these properties that you want a kind of intermediate value. If the shear resistance is very high, then the toe can't dig into the surface and you get high forces in the check ligament, the deep flexor, and in the navicular region. If you've got moderate shear resistance, then the foot can dig in and push off against the surface, but the surface gives enough resistance for the hoof to push against it. If the shear resistance is too low, and this would be, you know, the situation I talked about on the deep, dry sand, then the surface gives way as the hoof pushes off. So something in the middle, moderate shear resistance, is what we really like. Now, when you see kickback, where this leg has just come, this hoof has just come off the ground, and the ground is spraying up behind the hoof, that's the equivalent of when the foot digs in and pushes up the footing in front of the hoof at contact. So it's a sign that the footing is somewhat loose and has a fairly low shear resistance, which is not all bad, actually. So how do we measure the properties of arena surfaces? Well, we can measure them with the live horse, or we can measure them with a mechanical tester. There has been some live horse measurements performed in France, but all of those have been done with a racing standard bred, so perhaps not quite applicable to our dressage horses. There have been a lot of testing of thoroughbred racetracks, and many of the FEI competition arenas in Europe have been tested with the Orono tester. It has a hoof simulator mounted on a couple of rails that are at a slight angle to the ground, so it simulates the angle of approach of the hoof to the ground in a live horse. And it's dropped onto the surface and then raised up again, and it leaves an imprint of the hoof, the simulated hoof. And there are accelerometers in that device that measure the rate of deceleration, and so they measure the hardness of the surface. There's had lots of testing done on racetracks and comparing dirt and synthetic racetracks. So when the racetracks went from dirt to synthetic, the statistics would show that there was a reduction in catastrophic injuries. And a catastrophic injury is usually one where the horse breaks a leg and then has to be put down. But, interestingly, it was observed that there is an increase in sore backs and also an increase in joint injuries, particularly hind fetlock joints, which I think is related to the fact that the ground is, the synthetic track is stopping the foot more quickly. So the higher shear resistance on the synthetic. With regard to other sports, one of our challenges is with multi-purpose arenas. And of course, our high-level competitions like the Olympics, we have dressage and jumping in the same arena. And the footing requirements are somewhat different. The jumpers are really concerned with security. They're going to be galloping, turning at speed, taking off, landing. They don't want to slip. And that's fine for us. We don't mind the fact that we're not going to slip. But we really like something that has a little bit more rebound, a little bit softer and sort of bouncier. And it's not possible at this point in time to make an arena surface that would be perfect for both. London was a special challenge. I think most of you probably know that they were not allowed to put anything on the hallowed grass at Greenwich. So the arenas were built up on these pillars. Right? They were raised up above the ground, and then a platform constructed, and the footing was put on top of the platform. And when they had the trial event, they erected this whole platform, and the jumpers were not happy with the footing. So the footing had to be changed, but they couldn't change and assess it in situ because the platform had to be taken away. And it was only put back up just before the Olympics. So, you know, it really was a challenge to get the footing right and put it down on the day for the Olympics and have it function as hoped for. They tested the footing away from the actual site of the Olympics. And they knew how they had to change it, but they just had to have confidence that when they changed it and they put it on that particular surface, on base, that it would still work. So, in dressage, the limb loading is relatively low compared with other sports, particularly in our most collected gaits. I think high shear resistance can be a problem for us, and high shear resistance is a characteristic of the synthetic footings. And it's a problem in that it stops the hoof too quickly, especially in the extensions, which increases concussion. And it doesn't allow the foot to twist on the surface. And sometimes a little bit of twisting is good, but if the hoof is completely fixed and the upper part of the leg is twisting, then you get that sort of torquing of the joints. In the pirouette, the inside hind leg is on the ground for about 50% of the stride. It's the main balancing leg. And during each stride, the horse is rotating through about 45 to 60 degrees. So it's that inside hind that's primarily at risk for one of these torquing type injuries. So maintenance is another consideration. It's not something I'm going to go into here, but horses do move best on a consistent surface. And we know from the racetrack studies that the longer it is since the track was maintained, the more likely it is that there's going to be an accident or an injury to a horse.
And our thanks again to Dr. Hilary Clayton for this presentation on what every dressage rider should know about footing. If you want the most complete resource on dressage arena footing, the new 2015 edition of Underfoot is now available for purchase in a digital version on the website at usdf.org and the printed version through the USDF online store. For more educational material on these and other topics, please go to eTrack, the USDF's online learning centre and resource. And that wraps up this week's program. Don't forget that you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and via the new USDF Connection app. Until next week, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.